Hello and welcome to Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, does new evidence of a shoot-to-kill policy along the former East German border come as such a surprise?
Everyone knew that they were allowed to kill people who were crossing the border, so I don't know why everyone is so surprised about this, because everybody knew about it, that there was an order to kill people who were crossing the border.
Also on the program, France is working hard this holiday month to deport more illegal immigrants than ever before. Will Romania's Orthodox Church face up to its communist past? And we'll take a stroll through Amsterdam's Hash Museum. All this, plus our latest quiz coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters, this week coming to you from Bonn, Germany. I'm Sabina Casagrand. It was 46 years ago this week that construction began on the Berlin Wall. It divided the city for close to three decades and became one of the most notorious symbols of the Cold War. Many who tried to flee over the wall paid with their lives. But the former East German leadership always denied that there was an official order to kill. Now a document has come to light proving that East German border guards had explicit orders to shoot at people who were trying to flee to West Berlin. Deutsche Welle's Joanna Impey has the details.
Charlottenecke Zimmerstraße, Sektorengrenze. Vor genau einer Stunde forderte die Mauer erneut ein Opfer.
A West German radio reporter describes the scene after Peter Fechter was shot dead at the Berlin Wall in 1962. He was one of well over 150 people who were killed whilst trying to escape to West Berlin. It's no secret that border patrols shot at those who tried to flee across the border, but a document discovered last week by archivists in the eastern German city of Magdeburg provides written evidence that the regime ordered border guards to fire without warning, and even to use their weapons against women and children who attempted to cross the border. The former East German leadership, including the last General Secretary of the party, Egon Krenz, still denies that a shoot-to-kill policy ever existed. But Marianne Biertler and her team at the government agency that now manages the Stasi, or East German secret police, files, said that the document proves otherwise. She claims that the upper echelons of the GDR regime knew of the shoot-to-kill policy.
Wichtig ist dieser Fund, weil bis heute immer wieder bestritten wird, dass es ein Schießbefehl an der Mauer gegeben hat.
This document is important because some still deny that there was an official order to kill. The document proves clearer than any other that such an order did exist.
The orders were issued to a special Stasi unit in the border patrol, which was charged with preventing guards from fleeing to the west with their families. There were other documents that referred to the use of firearms, but only if the fugitives ignored calls to stop. In the new 7-page paper, there is no reference to such warnings.
Do not hesitate to use your firearm, not even when the border is breached in the company of women and children, which is a tactic the traitors have often used.
This passage was taken from the document, which dates from October 1973. It's a significant find for those who want to take judicial proceedings against former Stasi employees, who have largely gone unpunished since German unification in 1990. Hubertus Knabe is head of the Memorial for Stasi Victims in Berlin Hohenschönhausen and has called for prosecutors in Magdeburg to investigate the findings.
Das jetzt aufgefundene Dokument ist ja eine Art Lizenz zum Töten.
The rediscovered document is a kind of license to kill, and that didn't exist before. It's only directed at Stasi workers, but I think that an urgent investigation is needed into the case for a criminal prosecution.
The document, however, does not carry any names. It will therefore prove difficult to initiate trials. Some critics have asked why it's taken so long for the discovery to be made public, as a similar document was published in a history book 10 years ago. The agency that manages the Stasi files has been criticized for the oversight. Some are even claiming that the disclosure was deliberately delayed to coincide with the 46th anniversary of the construction of the wall. On the streets of Berlin, the debate has provoked a mixed reaction.
Naturally, this could be something very bad for the image of the east of Germany, because there are a lot of people nowadays who still think DDR was a good country, had a good system.
Everyone knew that they were allowed to kill people who were crossing the border, so that's no news to me at all. I don't know why everyone is so surprised about this, because everybody knew about it, that there was an order to kill people who were crossing the border.
18 years after the fall of the wall, a surprising number of Eastern Germans are heard speaking fondly about what life was like back then. The current debate might serve as a reminder of the brutality of the East German regime. Joanna Impey, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn.
Try getting anything done in France during August and you'll come up against a wall. Everything is closed as most people are on vacation. But apparently not everyone is out of commission. According to some immigrant rights groups, the immigration police are working hard, deporting more illegal immigrants this summer than ever before. RFI's Sarah Alzis reports from Paris.
Tuesday night, about 100 people are gathered on a corner in Paris's Belleville neighborhood, one of the most diverse in the city. Solidarity with illegal immigrants, they chant. It's a monthly gathering organized by several immigrant rights groups. This one is dedicated to Ivan, a 12-year-old Russian boy who's in critical condition after he fell out a fourth-floor window last week as police tried to enter his family's apartment, possibly to deport them. Observers say they've seen an increase in deportations this summer, particularly in the last couple of weeks.
We're organized enough to be told when so-and-so is being detained in a police station, and we were just spending more and more time in front of police stations.
Claire Grover is a member of the Education Without Borders Network, which organizes support for illegal immigrants facing deportation.
It's happening in August when most of France is on vacation, so there is little reaction from the population.
Caroline Lepin provides legal aid to immigrants in a detention center near the Roissy airport. She says that it's hard to tell if there are more detainees this August because the center is always full to capacity, though she has noticed a change in police tactics.
People have been telling us that they've been brought into detention from their homes. We've never seen this kind of procedures before. Normally, somebody is intercepted on the French territory when they register at the prefecture, or if they commit a crime, or during a regular ID check.
Is there an increase in deportations? Are more people being arrested at home? It's hard to tell because there are no statistics. The Minister of Immigration, Brice Hortefeux, last week specifically denied an increase of deportations in August, though the left-leaning Libération newspaper recently published a memo from a prefecture in the Paris area written in July asking police to prioritize deportation cases. This worries advocates like Claire Grover, who says most illegal immigrants have done nothing wrong.
They have all but the papers. They live quiet lives and they're certainly of no harm to anybody, and their children are probably among the future of this country.
What angers Grover and others is that many of those being deported have been living in France for several years. They have spouses and children in school. The system that used to tolerate them no longer does. Even though they are illegal, they do have rights. Caroline Lepin explains that someone who's in deportation proceedings can make a case in front of a judge to be allowed to stay.
The person needs to prove that he or she has a strong enough family presence in France. What's important is the number of years they have been in France, and the family members must be close, like a spouse, kids, or parents.
Immigration has long been a volatile issue in France, and the tension is only growing with the new government. President Nicolas Sarkozy has made immigration reform a priority. You could feel the tension at the Belleville demonstration. In the metro station underneath, police were checking IDs, not unusual in an immigrant-heavy neighborhood like this one, though slightly provocative given what was happening above ground. They stopped one man who had hopped the turnstile, inciting an angry response. Police everywhere, justice nowhere, shouted people. Police sequestered the man inside the ticket booth. Other officers came down for reinforcement. Finally, the man was let go. The crowd cheered.
Je suis français.
I'm French, says the man, who's black. He's originally from the Comoros Islands.
J'ai voté, j'ai tout, pour vous montrer que moi, je suis pas clandestin.
I voted, he says. I had everything to show that I'm not illegal. He wasn't going to the demonstration. He just got caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. Activists may need to make much more noise in the coming months, as the Ministry of Immigration has set a goal of deporting 25,000 people from France by the end of the year. For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Paris.
More than 2,500 delegates from over 140 nations gathered in Stockholm this week for the annual World Water Conference. Every year, scientists, government officials, campaigners, and representatives from private industry converge on the Swedish capital to discuss water-related issues. Radio Sweden's Azariah Kiros attended the opening ceremony and has this report.
Water is abundant in some places and scarce in others. Water, or the absence of clean water, is also the source of innumerable diseases which lead to the loss of millions of lives every year. That was why the Stockholm Water Institute wanted to put the limelight on water and started the annual tradition of bringing together all working with water and water-related issues to a week of discussions. And this year's mega conference, the 17th of its kind, has brought together more than 2,500 delegates from more than 140 countries. And the main theme of this year's encounter is the link between water and climate change. Corinne Lexien is one of the project directors at the Stockholm International Water Institute, the organizer of the World Water Week.
We want to emphasize the impact on water and the availability of water, and also the consequences of a disturbed water cycle. It's both a question of management, but also a question of physical appearance. And you can see in some regions that you do have physical scarcity, like, for instance, in parts of Africa and in the Middle East. On other places, you do have water available, but you don't have the technique to transfer it to poor people in terms of drinking water and clean water, etc.
Water may be scarce in some parts, but is abundant in others. The question is, how do you share the resources without creating frictions among nations? And how much have conferences such as the World Water Week helped, not only in raising awareness, but also providing solutions to the seemingly intractable problems? Sunita Naren, a leading Indian environmental activist, is the director of the Centre for Science and Environment. Her commitment to improve water and sanitation in India and other parts of the world earned her the prestigious Stockholm Water Prize 2 years ago. She says while awareness about water-related problems is growing, enough is not being done to find solutions to the problems.
I believe the water issue has really grown in its importance and its urgency. And I think forums like this are very important because they remind us just how important the issue is. They bring together the new ideas in terms of looking at the way ahead. But it is also very clear that if you look at the balance sheet of what have we achieved, we still have a long way to go.
Sunita Naren and other campaigners who want to highlight water-related issues may be happy with the growing awareness, but say politicians and other decision-makers can do more to help solve water-related problems. Sweden's Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt delivered the keynote address at the opening of the World Water Week. Later, at a press meeting, I put this question to him.
Mr. Prime Minister, do you feel that there is sufficient awareness among politicians around the world about the seriousness of this problem?
Oh yes, I think the awareness is there.
And the willingness?
And the willingness as well, but as always regarding these matters, it stands against other important things, but the knowledge is there, the interest is there.
Do you feel that the developing countries themselves are taking sufficient measures to be able to tackle the problem?
Well, we have learned that when countries are not really functioning sufficient, everything tends to be working more poorly.
So how do water campaigners respond to the Swedish Prime Minister's claim that lack of democracy and the absence of peace and security may hamper the struggle to improve access to water and sanitation. Sunita Naren.
I think developing countries are absolutely clear that this is serious. I don't think anyone needs to preach to them that this is an important issue. And what we really need is an ability to recreate our own ways of managing our water and also finding new ways to manage our sanitation.
And that report was by Radio Sweden's Azariah Kiros. You're listening to Network Europe, a co-production of Europe's leading international broadcasters. Heading now to Romania, where the communist archives are still the skeleton in the closet for both politicians and high clergy alike. The Romanian Orthodox Church is now at a turning point after its patriarch passed away at the beginning of the month. The search for his successor has reopened the highly sensitive issue of the relationship between church leaders and the communist authorities before 1989. Radio Romania International's Iulian Muresan reports from Bucharest.
These are scenes from the funeral of the patriarch of the Romanian Orthodox Church earlier this month. 92-year-old Teoctist, who led the Romanian Orthodox Church for more than two decades, passes away, closing one chapter in the history of the Romanian Orthodox Church. Patriarch Teoctist will be remembered for the visit of Pope John Paul II to Romania in 1999, the first visit by a pope to a majority Orthodox country. He also left behind a relatively thriving church and a new generation of well-trained priests and theologians. But unfortunately, there are also darker spots in the life of Teoctist. He was accused of having failed to oppose the demolition of churches by the communists and actually having too good a relationship with the Securitate, which was the communist secret police. Also, in 17 years of transition, the church has had a dubiously good relation with politics, especially with the successive regimes led by pretty much the same former communists. And the post-communist history of the Romanian Orthodox Church has also been marked by a lack of transparency, as the leaders of the church have not been very willing to dig into their own past. You're listening to the late Patriarch Teoctist in an interview on Radio Romania in November last year.
În 97 am comunicat că suntem favorabili deschiderii dosarului.
Even as early as the Holy Synod of 1997, we said we were favorable to the opening of the Securitate archives, knowing that we shall be judged by our Lord Jesus and that we shall have to confess our sins on Judgment Day. That is our responsibility.
After Patriarch Teoctist passed away, a new scandal broke in Romania, again related to the Securitate archives. This time it is the relation between the high clergy and the communists that is under scrutiny. Before 1989, Mircea Dinescu was a famous dissident poet. Now he is a member of the National Council for the Study of the Securitate Archives. A few days ago he came out with an example of a bishop who allegedly asked the communist leaders to be made a Securitate general, as he had been too long just a colonel. The Romanian patriarchy reacted promptly, intimating that Mr. Dinescu may be taken before justice for making accusations without backing them by evidence. Father Constantin Stoica, the spokesman of the Romanian patriarchy.
Acuzația pe care o aduce vrednicului de pomenire Mitropolit Antonie nu este probată.
The accusations brought to the late Bishop Antonie is not supported by evidence. Instead, I would say it is mind-blowing. I think that when Mr. Dinescu made that statement, he guided himself by the principle slander, slander, slander. Maybe something comes out of this.
On September the 12th, the Holy Synod of the Romanian Orthodox Church will elect a new patriarch. But Mircea Dinescu warns that if the new patriarch is appointed without first consulting the communist archives, we might end up with a scandal similar to the one in Poland 8 months ago, when Archbishop of Warsaw, Stanisław Wielgus, had to resign on accusations of having collaborated with the communist authorities. Mircea Dinescu, member of the National Council for the Study of the Securitate Archives.
Noi nu suntem puși la CNSAS acolo,
să mai ascundem o dată secretele fostei securități.
The role of the CNSAS is not to hide once more the secrets of the former Securitate. We are there to expose the Securitate as a political police. The church should be happy that, at last, they have a good chance to come clean and separate the wheat from the chaff. But instead, they want to see me behind bars.
It's been 17 years since the anti-communist revolution in Romania, time in which the politicians of Romania have definitely lost an honesty bet on their communist past. The political class has proved incapable of genuine reform. Now the Romanian Orthodox Church has a chance to wash many of its sins and start afresh. But judging from its resilience to find out the truth about the communist past of its future leaders, the church doesn't look too determined to take advantage of this opportunity.
Radio Romania International's Iulian Muresan had that report. And moving now from one church to another, an order of Polish monks has come up with an unusual business idea to support themselves. Now, you may not yet be familiar with prayer book apricot jam or Novice Brothers pickled mushrooms, but the monks' line of products is gaining ground. Michał Kubicki from the Polish Radio External Service visited the Benedictine monks of Tyniec Abbey near Krakow and has this report.
The day at Tyniec starts with a 6 o'clock prayer, and there are four more prayer sessions later in the day. The monks here are the Benedictines. Their order's motto is Ora et Labora, pray and work. And indeed, they are the men of both prayer and hard work. Over a year ago, they came up with the idea of starting a business venture. As the abbot of Tyniec, Father Bernard Sawicki, told me, the move was dictated by the need to face the challenges of present-day reality.
The community itself should find means for living through its own activity. Because we have changes in our country, we need to adapt our activity to new conditions. That's how the new idea came into being. So we decided to launch a sort of commercial activity. We discovered that there's a great need in the society of some products of the high quality.
The line of products offered by the Benedictine monks includes jams, marmalades, honey, pickled mushrooms, dried fruit, herbal teas, juices and cheeses, all of them made according to the monastery's centuries-old recipes, with ecological ingredients. The products are sold in a shop on the monastery premises, on its website and through a supermarket chain. Just over a year after the venture got off the ground, the monks can surely talk of a success. Abbot Bernard Sawicki looks with optimism into the future.
We hope that within 2 years, 100 shops of our products will be open in the whole country. I think this is for the main concern and to control the quality of the products.
In addition to a fast expanding range of food products, the monks at Tyniec plan to offer picnic baskets, liturgical music CDs, as well as wines from the Benedictine Abbey in Hungary. A monk in charge of the business venture has started business management studies. 12 lay employees have been taken on to help the monks run the business. Perched on a cliff above the Vistula River, the monastery is a wonderful place to visit, not only to do your shopping, but also as a retreat. The monks have a couple of rooms for guests who want to share in community life or simply to relax. That's an offer for the men only, but everyone is invited to visit the Abbey's website. It's www.benedicite.pl.
And that report was by Polish Radio's Michał Kubicki. Europe is in the grip of summer holidays, and many visitors to Amsterdam this summer are disappointed to find that two of the Dutch capital's world-famous museums are closed for renovation, with only a tiny portion of their collections on show. But there are a wealth of other smaller museums in the city to visit. Louise Dunn from Radio Netherlands Worldwide ventured into Amsterdam's Hash Museum.
Amsterdam's Hash Museum, or Museum of Hash, Marijuana and Hemp, to give it its full title, is to be found on one of the canals running through the city's red light district. Tourists of all ages and nationalities are drawn to the area by its reputation as a haven of easily accessible sex and drugs. Sitting at a canal-side cafe, I talked to Ken Johnson, the museum's manager, or plant curator, as he prefers to be called. And he told me that although most foreigners think soft drugs are legal in the Netherlands, that's far from the case.
It's illegal for virtually everyone except the coffee shops, who can have a small amount, but where they get it from is a bit of a legal mystery, and regular users in very small amounts. But no, it's very tightly controlled.
Okay, so the coffee shops exist and they're allowed to exist, but the people who supply them are criminals.
Oh yes, breaking the law. It's the intersection of sane drug laws versus insane international obligations, basically. I don't think Holland really wants to give up the revenue associated with cannabis and cannabis tourism, but it wants to be seen to be doing something for countries like Sweden and France and Germany and most especially the US.
As we stroll to the museum, Ken tells me the Dutch approach has resulted in a rate of cannabis use lower than almost all Western countries, even those which take a draconian attitude to the drug. At the museum itself, the shop, which sells cannabis seeds, is doing a roaring trade. We jump the queue of mostly young visitors and enter. There's not really a scent of cannabis in the air, is there?
I can't smell one, no.
Okay. Oh, I see here. We've got a sort of history of cannabis here.
It was grown in enormous amounts all over Europe for 500 years. It's the single most important fibre. It rigged every ship that sailed the world. All the sails, all the ropes were made from cannabis.
As we walk past drawings of the machines once used to strip hemp fibre, Ken talks about the transformation of cannabis from vital crop to outlawed substance.
The prohibition of cannabis is an incredibly irrational movement. Basically, it's got links to racism, to social control, to industrial monopolies. Unfortunately, hemp is so useful, it's also a medicine and a drug, and it happened to be a drug mostly used by blacks and Mexicans, which was a very useful way to ban it. And that's actually where the word marijuana comes from. It was sort of the 20s equivalent of the word terrorism. It was designed to undercut people's thoughts. Everyone knew what hemp was, and if they tried to ban hemp on the floor of Congress, it would get a very different reaction. So they rebranded it as marijuana.
Oh, which sounds more threatening.
Yeah.
Continuing past a series of paintings which depict Hindu and other religious ceremonies involving cannabis, we come to a glass-walled room at the back of the museum, which is crammed with visitors. We can see quite a fine selection of cannabis plants growing. Now we get the smell as well, don't we?
These are all females, of course. Females are the only ones you really grow.
Do you ever have people trying to get into the growing room and rip some leaves off?
No, they have to go through a couple of doors, and they're always... You do get people occasionally wandering innocently in, but they don't really believe they're innocent.
The museum has displays of beers, books, comics, clothes, games, music, all inspired by hemp's recreational applications. But Ken says it's not just a crop to grow for fun. Cannabis is environmentally friendly, he says, as well as having a wide variety of practical, medical and nutritional uses. When I ask him why this seeming wonder plant has now got such a bad name, Ken makes an interesting comparison.
There's a curious parallel between the anti-masturbation movements of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, they were armed with endless reams of statistical data on how masturbation made people crazy. And you can draw such amazing parallels between those movements and the anti-cannabis movement that it's just a morally bad thing, and they come up with shaky reasons for why. But if you look at the data neutrally, conspiracy does fit very well.
Now, Ken Johnson's clearly a man who knows his subject, but for most of the museum's visitors, the history of hemp and its practical uses aren't nearly as important as that brightly lit glasshouse full of bushy plants. Legal or not, there's only one form of cannabis most of them are interested in.
Radio Netherlands' Louise Dunn brought us that report. And that's almost all we've got time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here's your chance to participate in this month's quiz.
That
That's a classic scene from Fanny and Alexander, a film by Swedish director Ingmar Bergman, who died earlier this month. The legendary film director won 3 Academy Awards for Best Foreign Film. And we want you to tell us the names of these 3 films. You can email your answer to contact@networkeurope.org. Or write to us via snail mail to Deutsche Welle Radio, European Desk, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 special prizes to give away, and we'll announce the winners at the end of this month. Network Europe is a partnership of Radio Netherlands, Radio Sweden, Radio France International, Radio Romania, Radio Prague, Polish Radio External Services, and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I'm Sabina Casagrand, saying thanks for tuning in.